What I'd like to do this evening is to talk a little bit about a very famous discourse of the Buddha called the Kalama Sutta, the discourse to the Kalamas, and a little bit of the background to the chain of thought that brought me to want to talk about this today. Was a kind of a conversation I overheard, or part of a dialogue I was part of this weekend with different people from different Buddhist traditions. I kind of, in a sense, kind of saw something or realized something about the Theravadan tradition that stood out much more in contrast than it had for me in the past. So I wanted to share that with you. And it's a little bit dangerous, of course, to talk about one's own tradition in contrast to someone else, as if they're the other. One of the problems of Buddhism is that, or one of the situations of Buddhism is that there's so many different schools of Buddhism. And each of them have their strengths and their kind of purpose. And people belong to particular ones and feel like the other people are the other. And I like it that in Hinduism, there's the idea that there's different paths, different yogas. There's, karma yoga for people who like to do service and work. There's jnana yoga for people who are more into the more, perhaps more the contemplative or intellectual approach to liberation. There's the bhakti yoga path. There's different kind of ways. And they're all kind of held, as far as I understand, in the same umbrella. They're all recognized as being equal paths. So in Buddhism, there is no such idea like that exactly. But if we see the different, Buddhist traditions kind of each have their own way, each have their own path. So I don't want to disparage any other path here today, but I thought it was interesting that in this dialogue, this discussion we're having, presentation, all the traditions present talked about the triple refuge. The refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha is something we all have in common. And it was quite beautiful, kind of quite inspiring. But then I realized that kind of implicit in some of the discussion was the understanding that in a couple of different traditions, there is a fourth refuge. And that's what became interesting, I thought. And in the Vajrayana tradition, the fourth refuge is the guru. And so you take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, and your guru. And then there's a kind of a whole system of how you relate to your guru. In the Theravada tradition, the fourth refuge is oneself. And so then the question is, how is it you can take refuge in yourself in a way that is reliable? You know, is a real source of refuge or protection? And then a little bit, in contrast to the Vajrayana tradition, often the teachings are imparted to you from your guru. Like there's the empowerments that you get. And so there's all this stuff that comes down to you from the guru, from the Lama or the teacher. And you're the recipient of this. And in the Theravada tradition, where oneself is the guru, oneself is the refuge, there's much more a sense that we're going to discover this. We have to do the work ourselves, that we're going to discover the truth, we're going to discover the path through our own endeavorings in it. It isn't so much something that's going to be handed to us as much as something that we engage in. And there's probably less difference between the traditions that I'm making out now, but I thought it was interesting, that distinction. And I think a lot of people come to the Theravada tradition or the Vipassana tradition because it requires very little belief in some other kind of authority that it's hard to believe in unless you're kind of a faith follower and you have some intuitive sense or faith or some reason to believe in it. And so the Vipassana tradition, Theravada tradition, emphasizes much more this way of engaging the practice in a kind of ordinary, down-to-earth kind of way and discovering the path as you do it yourself in the moment practice of awareness. The difficulty, a little bit, of the taking oneself as a refuge is that for Westerners, the idea of what it means to be a self gets entangled with that. And we have a very rich legacy here in the West of ideas of self and currents of what it means to be a self, how to fulfill oneself, that sometimes get confused with Buddhist practice. And so one of them, for example, is that to a great extent, we're the recipient or we live the legacy of the Romantic movement of European philosophy, and where the idea of self-expression became very important, and self-fulfillment, that you fulfill yourself through your emotional and your aesthetic, your artistic expression. And so the kind of freedom that you found by finding your true expression, who you really are, often in kind of an emotional sense to it, became kind of the quest of the Romantics. And so now we come down to the modern world, and this Romantic idea comes into some of the areas in the modern sense of self, that we needed discovering my true self and my true expression, who I really am and how I'm going to be in the world, how I'm going to express myself and my creative potential perhaps. Or kind of connected to the Romantic ideas that spiritual life has to do with an emotional experience of life, an emotional way of being in the world, a feeling of intimacy, a feeling of communion with, you know, some sense of aesthetic appreciation or some kind of emotional appreciation of the deity or of nature or something. There's a kind of and so what happened with the Romantics is that to some degree they bypass the traditional sources of authority for religious truth in favor of, kind of like the Protestants did, but in a much more direct way even, perhaps, for everyone's own personal experience. And sometimes the Romantics went so far as said that really the ultimate validity, ultimate truth, the ultimate kind of authority was your own experience, regardless of what anybody else said. And so the quest was for one's own experience. So in the modern world, here in modern California, you find some of these things in the way people pursue Buddhist practice. They're looking for Buddhism to help them get in touch with their true self, their true expression. They're looking for some kind of feeling to validate the sense that they've arrived or come to some religious important place, a spiritually important place. And I don't want to belittle any of this. I mean, I think it's part of our legacy, who we are, and it's wonderful things. But if we limit our understanding of Buddhism or Buddhist practice by this kind of finding the self or taking refuge in the self, then we're going to shortchange the possibility of what Buddhism has to offer of liberation, of somehow finding a kind of transformation within that doesn't involve some kind of emotional or aesthetic appreciation or intimacy or intuition or expression, but how we are. Is this making any sense to you? Some sense? So you know, this idea of taking refuge in oneself or relying on oneself, being one's own, you know, trusting oneself and finding the truth through oneself, is something that a lot of people come to Vipassana, come to Theravada Buddhism, really want to have their Buddhism say. And they find certain teachings in Buddhism resonate with that kind of interest. And one of them is this teaching called the Kalama Sutta, the Discourse of the Buddha to the Kalamas. And it's one of the very most quoted, a certain section of it is one of the most quoted pieces of the Buddha in the modern world, especially among kind of free thinkers, people who want to feel like it's all about my own personal kind of discovery of the truth. I can do away with any other religious authority, spiritual authority, gurus or whatever, texts, and just a matter of how I find my truth, and that's what it's all about. And someone showed me once a postcard that someone had where the Kalama Sutta was kind of reduced to, you know, one little short telegraph. And it was something basically like, you know, believe in yourself or something, or trust yourself, or it was kind of almost like a cartoon of what the Buddha had to actually say in this discourse. So I'll read you this famous paragraph, and then I'll go through the discourse with you a little bit, and you kind of pull it out. There's a wonderful Zen teacher called Yvonne Rand, and she once said it was her wish or her thought that this particular discourse, and I think she meant this paragraph, should be tattooed on the inside of everybody's eyelids. Partly because she'd seen so many people get involved in Buddhist practice and not understood this paragraph, and so had invested authority, invested belief or trust or in institutions and teachings and in people where they shouldn't have actually have invested so much in. They should have taken more responsibility for their own spiritual life. And she would have seen a lot less suffering in the Western Buddhist world if people had known this discourse, this paragraph. So this is the paragraph. Or the what was most quoted. So in terms of, you know, understanding what's spiritually true or religiously true, don't go by reports, by legends, by tradition, by scripture, by logical conjecture, by inference, by analogies, by agreement with your views, by probability, or by the thought, this contemplative is my teacher. What's left? It's a pretty exhaustive list, seemingly. And it's a lot of things, that a lot of sources of authority that a lot of religious people rely on, Buddhists and non-Buddhists. Scripture. I'm reading a scripture right now to you. So it's a little bit, you know, paradox at the best. So don't go by scripture. Don't go by tradition. This is the way the tradition says it should be, the custom or your family tradition or cultural conditioning or whatever. Don't go by the way, it's because that's the way it's been done. Or by legends. Legends, of course, includes, you know, myths and amazing stories we tell ourselves or each other that we know that religious people are quite fond of. They don't call their own stories legends. That's the other people. Then I like the one, logical conjecture. Or don't reason out. Here it says don't depend on reason to come to your spiritual religious truth. Now that's a challenge to these free thinkers. That's the whole. You know, it's one thing to kind of do away with scripture and teachers and all this, so that you can really rely on yourself. And what can you rely on? Your reason, right? You can reason it out. You can be a good, you know. Or inference, analogies, and then I like the one by agreement with your views. I mean, that's, you know, aren't my views right? And then he goes on, but then the Buddha offers in the second half of this paragraph what you can rely on, the alternative. So I'll keep you on the edges of your seat a little bit longer before I tell you this. So the context of this discourse is the Buddha is wandering around northern India, and he comes to this town called Kalama, where the Kalamas live. And the Kalamas encounter the Buddha, and they go to him and say, look, there's a lot of these spiritual people that come through here. It's kind of like a spiritual supermarket. They come through, and they all say that, you know, they have different teachings from each other, and they all say their teaching is the truth. Now, they were kind of wise, these people. So here came in, another spiritual teacher, came to town. But rather than telling him, you know, what's your teaching, you know, and some, you know, lay it all out, or giving him a chance to say this is the truth, they asked him kind of a trick question. They asked him, so he said, all these people come through and they all say this is the truth. How do we know which one is true? Or how do we know how to find the truth? And so the Buddha answers, of course you are uncertain, Kalamas. Of course you are in doubt. When there is reason for doubt, uncertainty is born. So in this case, don't go by reports, by legends, by traditions, by scripture, by logical conjecture, by inference, by analogies, by agreement with your views, by probability, or by the thought, this contemplative is our teacher. So when you get all these people coming through giving teachings, don't take their teachings as being true just because of these reasons. That's kind of context for what's going on here. And but then he says, the Buddha says, when you know for yourself, and this is a tricky thing, when you know for yourself, And that's kind of what free thinkers like to think. You know, you have to know it for yourself. But the question is, how can you know reliably? And there's a whole school of philosophy, I suppose, psychology, philosophy, that studies very carefully how accurate our knowing is. And often our knowing is not that accurate. When is there, isn't there, weapons of mass destruction? at a very gross level. Or the issue of memory. Is memory accurate? I know my memory is, really accurate. When I remember. but memory is not so accurate because memory shifts over time. You remember things differently from different times. The fish gets bigger each telling of the story. And or we get some new piece of information, or we realize how much is interpretation in the memory. So the idea of knowing is a little bit challenged by modern kind of studies of how human beings know. So the idea of simply saying, I'm going to know for myself, that's what spiritual life is about. I'm going to know for myself. Then the scientists come and say, well, if you start analyzing how is it you know what you think you know, then, you're on shaky ground because there's a lot of inference, there's a lot of guesses, there's a lot of assumptions, there's a lot of interpretations going on there. And upon what basis do you believe this? I think a lot of our sense of self, how we understand who we are as people and what we need to do as human beings, the basic underlying assumptions underneath that is missing. It is not seen very clearly for us, for ourselves. Another kind of strand current that went into wanting to give this talk today, which I'll just mention to you, but I didn't know how to weave it in, but so it's a footnote, is I had a long talk this morning with someone who is deeply troubled by all the good works she does. She's works for a wonderful nonprofit that does a lot of really good work, social action work, and she's involved in different kind of groups, and she's too busy. And she's also a practitioner, and where does she fit her practice in? And she's just kind of overwhelmed, suffering by all these demands, and the world has no end to social needs. And so she's got there to save them, right? So you have to do, she was being burdened by it. But in talking with her, I pointed out what I've been saying sometimes lately is, I am in awe of this seemingly contagious disease that a lot of people in our society have. And the contagious illness is the epidemic, is being overly busy, having too many things to do. And there's a lot of reasons, I suppose, for it, many, many reasons for it. But I think some of it has to do with what we understand it means to be a human being in our modern life, and what we understand what we think it means to be fulfilled as a human being. And that comes, those ideas come from many different sources, but some of it comes from the Romantic movement itself. But we don't see that. We don't know that. So when we say, I'm going to know for myself, and we don't understand the assumptions, the lenses through which we want to know something, then how reliable is that knowing? So the Buddha is problematizing, making a problem, kind of challenging people not to believe in these other sources of religious knowledge. Of course, the paradox here is that he's expecting them to believe him. And he's a teacher, right? But he says, when you know for yourself, so what does it mean? So what can you know? How can you reliably know something for yourself? But this is what the Buddha says. When you know for yourself that these qualities are unskillful, these qualities are blameworthy, these qualities are criticized by the wise, these qualities, when undertaken and carried out, lead to harm and to suffering, then you should abandon them. So he's kind of narrowing the window in the sense of what you can know. He's saying, when these qualities here means internal mental states, the qualities of the mind, the actions, the behavior of the mind, the heart. When you know these qualities of the heart are unskillful. Unskillful means that maybe another translation that makes more sense to us is when you know these qualities of heart are unhealthy. When you know that being driven by greed, wanting to do more and more and more, or driven by sense of responsibility that just can't say no when it's time to say no, when you see that these qualities are unhealthy, then you should abandon them. So somehow the Buddha is saying, you're able to know the quality of your heart or the quality of your mind. And you can know the direction that your mind is going in or your heart is going in. Is it going in a direction that's healthy or unhealthy? That's a very simple kind of criteria. This is what you should know. So it's not saying if you know great spiritual truths about God or the nature of reality or the true nature of the self. It's saying you can know something about the quality of your own heart. Is it healthy? Is it going in a healthy direction or is it not? And then he goes on you can know whether these qualities are blameworthy or not. Blameworthy is a little bit problematic for us because the idea of blame and praise is kind of problematic. But I think taken more innocently that certain things, if you have a certain level of self-respect, then to violate your own sense of self-respect by doing something that is contrary to that would be considered blameworthy. We consider it to be something that doesn't feel good, doesn't feel right, feels something that you somehow would evaluate as being, you know, not something to be done. So again, it's focusing on qualities of the heart, qualities of the mind. And then it goes on and says, these qualities are criticized by the wise. So here, the Buddha is saying, you don't only rely on what you know for yourself, but you're willing to take the opinion of other wise people into account. It doesn't mean that you believe them absolutely, but you listen to your elders. You listen to the people who are wise around you, who've had much more experience perhaps, and take their into account that they say, oh, you know, going around robbing banks is not a good idea. You know, and you know, your favorite, you know, grandmother tells you that. You know, maybe I should listen to that. And then this is the last phase, I think, is one of the most important ones here. When you know for yourself that these qualities, when undertaken and carried out, lead to harm and to suffering, then you should abandon them. So here, what the Buddha is saying you could know is you could know whether the activity of your heart, the activity of your mind, the qualities there, lead to greater suffering and to harm or not. So this idea of being overly busy. You know, there's a lot of wonderful, important, good causes in the world to be engaged in, but we can't do them all. But if you do one, it might feel really great, and it actually leads to your own sense of well-being and purpose and meaning, and it benefits other people also. But when you sign up for the 30-second nonprofit, or a certain, you know, project to be involved in, at some point, doing so causes more suffering and harm because of the way that the heart is getting kind of dried out or, you know, burdened or fragmented by all these different kind of activities. So to have some sense, some capacity to track whether we are moving in a direction that causes suffering or away from suffering. That is, the Buddha says, something you can reliably know for yourself. Now, that's a very limited domain of knowledge. And for some spiritual and religious people, it's completely inadequate in terms of real religious knowledge, isn't it? I mean, where are the big things? Where are the really important issues? Where's God? Where's liberation? Where's, you know, oneness with nature? Or where's, you know, whatever. There's very little, you know, these kind of ultimate religious things being stated here, but it's something very simple. And you could maybe, if you're kind of creative in how you use the term, you could say, in a sense, this is just therapy. And therapy, not necessarily psychotherapy, but therapy in terms of, like, you know, healing, moving towards, away from suffering, moving towards health. Then the Buddha. So that's the famous paragraph. Maybe it's not so clear. So the Buddha now is going to elaborate a little bit what he means here. And this is the next section of it, is elaboration. And he does this in a Socratic fashion, where he asks questions of the audience and they answer back. And he asks the Kalamas, "What do you think? When greed arises in a person, does it arise for welfare or for harm?" So I'll ask you. So when greed arises in you, is that for your welfare or for your harm? What?
For your welfare, you want to be more and more.
For your benefit?
Sometimes for the welfare, because you want more.
More and more.
For the good, because it's good. Mm-hmm.
So it could be. So we have different opinions here. Well, the Kalamas, they said, for harm. And then the Buddha goes on. "And this greedy person, overcome by greed, his mind possessed by greed, kills living beings, takes what is not given, goes after another's spouse, tells lies, and induces others to do likewise, all of which is for long-term harm and suffering." So somehow here he says very dramatically that if you engage in greedy activity severely, I mean, if a major kind of greed, that it leads to a certain kind of unethical behavior. I think a lot of you here are not about to go out and kill and do these kinds of things. But probably some of you have recognized certain kind of greed, certain kind of drivenness that around desire, kind of clutching desire. It doesn't feel good in and of itself when you're paying attention to it. And so there's suffering right in just having it. To be driven or to have a repetitive greed, to have that being one of the kind of dispositions of your character, puts a tremendous strain on the body and the mind and the heart over time. And it kind of causes it to dry out over time. It can cause long-term harm. Also acted on, it can cause harm in the wider world. And it's been pointed out by many people that a certain kind of greed of consumerism has a tremendous impact on the wider world, the economic world and the environmental world. And, the level of consumerism in some countries in this world, is it an expression of greed? Or is it an expression of reasonable lifestyles that everyone should have? Now, what do you think? When hate arises in a person, does it arise for welfare or for harm? Well, they said, it's for harm. And then he goes through the same thing again. And then he goes to the next thing. When delusion arises for the person, does it arise for welfare or for harm? And they say for harm. And then he goes through the same thing again. So what do you think, Kalamas? Are these qualities skillful or unskillful? They produce health or they produce disease? And they say they produce disease. Are they blameworthy or blameless? They're blameworthy. Are they criticized by the wise or praised by the wise? Criticized by the wise. When undertaken and carried out, do they lead to harm and to suffering or not? And they say it does lead to harm and suffering. And then the Buddha repeats again that famous paragraph. Don't go by legends and scriptures and tradition. And then he says, he actually repeats it twice to really drive it home. It's kind of like the refrain of this discourse. And then he goes through the same kind of questioning of them, others, by saying, when the lack of greed arises in a person, does it arise for welfare or for harm? And they say, for welfare. Now, what you have to understand is that in the ancient Indian Buddhist tradition, maybe in ancient India, the absence of something, absence of an unhealthy quality like greed, did not mean only nothing, but implied the presence of the opposite quality. So the absence of greed implied the presence of generosity. The absence of hate implied the presence of love. And the absence of delusion implied the presence of wisdom. You could make a little metaphysical teaching about this, saying that when you strip away hate, then it's the nature of the heart to be loving. When you strip away greed, it's nature to be generous. The Buddha never made that kind of metaphysical claim, but you could almost see it here. And so then he goes through these mind free of greed, heart free of hate, heart free of delusion. And they go say, these things are skillful, they're blameless, they're not criticized, and they lead to welfare and to happiness. So again, the implication here is that you can know qualities of your heart, qualities of your mind, and whether they move you towards health or suffering or harm or not. And the implication here is that it's important to track this. It's very important to track this movement. And what I see in people, a lot of people, including myself, is not tracking this carefully enough. Overlooking the ways in which we allow ourselves to suffer. The woman today that I talked to, she had built up, she had neglected to pay attention to the way in which her social activism had slowly over time, the years and months or whatever, built up as a kind of stress in her system. If she had paid attention to that level of stress earlier, she would have probably could have made wiser decisions. But she was blinded by her sense of responsibility that it's up to her to go out there and answer the calls that were coming in. So the question for you is, are you paying careful enough attention to your suffering and to what brings you benefit? Now, this also is something that's very delicate to look at, because to look at one's own suffering and one's own welfare could be narcissistic. It's not necessarily spiritually beneficial always. If there's an excessive focus or misunderstanding of what benefit actually is. So if you think that what's ultimately beneficial for you is to have a Rolls Royce, a mansion, infinite recreational partners, or whatever it might be, then that's not going to be, you know, that's probably an expression of greed. And greed is understood to be unhealthy in and of itself. So in doing this analysis, you have to be very careful. The Buddha's not saying, be very careful how you understand what benefit is here and what harm is here. And I believe he's saying, use the presence and absence of greed, hate, and delusion as part of the markers for that differentiation. And in the Buddhist tradition, greed, hate, and delusion are called the three roots out of which all other unhealthy motivations spring from. And non-greed, non-hate, and non-delusion are the three roots from which healthy motivations and actions in the world come from. So when the Buddha focuses on greed, hate, and delusion here, he's talking about kind of something very, very fundamental to who we are. So are you following me adequately enough? Yeah? And does it seem relevant enough? Shall we go on?
Yes.
Now we come to the last section of the discourse, which is quite beautiful, I think. And now he's going to give an example. Now, in a person who is thus devoid of greed, hate, or just say delusion, just greed and hate. What happened to delusion? Who is thus devoid of greed and hate. Oh, yes, it does. It's just an undiluted. So devoid of greed, hate, and delusion. Alert and resolute. Keeps pervading the eastern direction as well as southern, the western, the northern, with an awareness imbued with loving kindness. Thus she keeps pervading above, below, and all around, everywhere, and in every respect, the all-encompassing cosmos with an awareness imbued with loving kindness, abundant, expansive, immeasurable, free from hostility, free from ill will. So here, the person who's free from greed, hate, and delusion is practicing the practice of loving kindness. And supposedly has to some degree mastered this practice, so they're kind of sending this vibes, sending this, this I don't know, vibes is probably not the Buddhist word, but sending the intention, sending the sentiment there of love in throughout the cosmos is the word, in all directions. So it isn't just love. You imagine the strongest love you felt for another person. And then imagine that maybe the strongest unromantic love you ever felt for some person. And then imagine that you can do that for the whole cosmos in all directions. That'd be pretty good, wouldn't it? So this is what's going on here. And then imagine the same person doing the same for compassion, pervading the whole cosmos with their compassion. And then doing the same thing with sympathetic joy, and then doing the same thing with equanimity. So these are some of the most skillful, most healthy activities, qualities of mind that a person can develop in Buddhism, is to develop these four qualities of love. Then the Buddha says, a person who's done this acquires four assurances in the here and now. So four benefits that you're assured of having. If there is a world after death, if you're reborn after death, remember he's talking to the Kalamas, and the Kalamas aren't Buddhists. So he doesn't assume, even though most Buddhists believe in rebirth, he's not assuming they believe in it because they're not Buddhists. They're just asking him, you know, for advice. So he's saying, if there is a world after death, if there is the fruit of actions in the next life, then that person will reappear in a good rebirth. In fact, the person will reappear in a heavenly realm. Isn't that nice? But if there is no world after death, if there is no fruit of actions in the next lifetime, then that person will look after him or herself with ease, free from hostility, free from ill will, and free from trouble. So if you do this practice, if you free yourself from greed, hate, and delusion, and live imbuing with loving kindness, then you'll dwell at ease in this lifetime. So you know Pascal's wager? It's kind of a little bit like that, right? Either way, you're going to get it's a good deal, right? Yeah. So, and then it says, the third one is, if evil is done through acting, still I have willed no evil for anyone. Having done no evil actions, from where will suffering touch me? This is a third assurance. The worldview of this is that suffering won't come to you unless it's the product of your own karma. If you do evil acts, it'll come back. The seeds you sow will come back, you know, and affect you. But then he says, but if no evil is done through acting, then I assume then that person can assume themselves pure in both respects. So here he's saying that even if karma is not a true teaching, still the person is pure because the purity of heart is there, and they can be sure of that. So here the Buddha, what he's saying is that you can track a little bit the direction that the qualities of your heart are going. And if they're going towards a healthy direction, watch that, follow that. If they're moving towards unhealthy directions, watch that and avoid those things. If you follow through on that which is unhealthy, it will produce harmful benefits for you, harmful results for you. If you follow through on what's beneficial, it will bring benefits to you. When they heard this, the Kalama said, magnificent. Magnificent. Just as if the Buddha were to place upright what had been overturned, were to reveal what was hidden, were to show the way to one who was lost, were to hold up a lamp in the dark so that those with eyes could see shapes. In the same way, the Buddha has, through many lines of reasoning, made the Dharma clear. We go to the Buddha for refuge, to the Dharma and to the Sangha. May the Buddha remember us as lay followers who have gone to him for refuge from this day forward for life. So they liked what they heard. And so in terms of what can be reliably known as an alternative to those lists of things you don't rely on, the Buddha is pointing to something very simple, very, very, very ordinary, and a very small area of our life. And that is, have mindfulness of what is going on in your hearts or in your minds. And be the safeguarder, be the protector, be the steward of your own heart. You can know when your heart is suffering. And you can know when your heart is not suffering. And that little distinction is centrally important for the Buddhist tradition. That's something you can know reliably. And knowing that reliably, you can make choices, or you can start making choices, or moving and making towards making choices, to live a life that moves away from suffering, liberates you from suffering, and moves you towards the freedom from suffering. What the Buddha did not teach the Kalamas, he did not teach them the ultimate teachings that he has. He didn't teach them about liberation itself. He talked about, you know, in this example of doing loving kindness in all directions, being reborn in heavenly realms, that's kind of understood to not to be the ultimate goal of Buddhism. The ultimate goal of Buddhism is the ultimate liberation, can be understood as being the ultimate liberation from those forces of greed, hate, and delusion, so the heart no longer has them at all. So the idea of kind of uprooting them once and for all, or completely, or at least moving in that direction so they're operating less and less and less, kind of slowly liberating it, purifying it. For some people, this is a very unsatisfying kind of religious message, because we would like from our religion something really grand, something really we can, you know, show our neighbors and be the best person in our block, or to get some great assurance, some great sense of safety because we know some ultimate kind of teaching. The Buddha was trying to offer some assurance here to people in this analysis that he gave. But the I think that if you follow this kind of practice, this guideline, you can really rely on yourself. You can rely on yourself in a reliable way. You can really depend. You can rely on what you know. If this is what you're studying, you can know, and it's going to transform your life dramatically if you take it seriously, and probably put you through the kind of spiritual changes that even people who have that also not even. But other people have much more grand religious ideas go through themselves. So that's how we become a refuge for ourselves in this tradition. So I hope that made enough sense today. I hope that if it didn't make sense or if it troubled any of you, then please just leave it here. Thank you.